Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this 13th day of May. It is a Tuesday. A quick thank you to all the folks who called in and the many people who supported us during WAMC Uninterrupted this morning. Thanks to the Vox Poppers who joined us in studio, as well as Ray and Sarah for their great work. And we thank you. Look, if anything you can do right now is much appreciated, WAMC.org. 1-800-323-9262. We'll get to the subjects at hand, and we have a few of them this morning, and we'll go to 11 o'clock. So here we go. Let me introduce the group to you. By the way, if you have anything to say about what we're talking about, and maybe you will, Panel@WAMC.org. Panel@WAMC.org. We welcome communications expert and founder, president of Stanhope Partners, Bob Bellafiore. Good morning, Bob. Welcome
back.
Hello,
Joe. How are you?
I'm well. Thank you very much. Good to have you here. Also, we welcome The Empire Report's J.P. Miller. Hello, J.P.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me.
It's really good to have you on the program, as always. Thank you. And Mike Spain is here. He is the former Times Union associate editor. Let me try that again. It's an associate editor is what he is. Was. Good morning. How are you?
I'm great. I'm really happy to be here. Beautiful day today, it looks like. So everything is good.
Yeah, we put in a lot to get to deserve days like this, right? You know, we paid our penance, as we say. Teresa Bourgeois joins us as well, public policy and communications expert. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Happy National Apple Pie Day. So have a slice, right?
All right,
or two,
yeah.
With a little a la mode, right?
Yeah. Anybody like cheddar cheese with their apple pie? Is that a thing that people, I thought that was an upstate New York thing, but maybe
that's crickets.
Not.
Crickets. But
isn't Ella Mode from Cambridge?
From Cambridge. Yeah,
New
the
York.
Cambridge Hotel was a pie Ella Mode, or so they say.
So they say. That's what the sign says.
I don't know if they've ever proven it, but yeah, sure. It's we take credit for it.
Fun listening this morning about the birds and stuff. Eagles. I'm all about the eagles.
Oh, it's great to have them. Yeah. It's great. Yeah.
Cheddar cheese on apple pie.
Yeah, melted. Yeah,
as
it has
a matter
to be
of fact, Bob, my late father-in-law, who was from upstate New York, enjoyed a nice slice of cheddar cheese next to his apple pie. It's a thing.
Yeah. Next to it,
it
not
to be,
on it.
It needs to be a little.
No,
melted,
you can
right?
do it. You can no. You
no?
can do it. You have the now.
Mine was always a little.
You can
my
grab
mother
a little bit with your fork of each, right?
My mother would claim that the best way to do this was you have the sharpest cheese possible, like what she referred to as rat trap cheese. You know what? Not one of the best marketing slogans in the world. It just didn't go.
My peanut butter works better.
I believe Cabot now calls it just extra, extra sharp as opposed to rat trap cheese. But you take some rat trap cheese, you put it next to the apple pie, and it brings out all the good flavor. So that's the word on that.
Well, just an apple with a little cheese slice is a... a good snack.
That's a good old snack. That's right.
Are we avoiding the difficult issues?
Well,
of the day?
I would love to. Believe you
they're
me.
They're really
but
difficult today. So.
Well,
I think something called rat trap cheese is a difficult issue.
Yes,
but that may just be me.
Especially
did
for
they
the
focus
rat.
Group well, that name.
Yes, I think you're right.
Maybe that's what we're headed to, a rat trap.
You know, once again, I know it comes out quite often when I say things like icebox and the like, but I just want to remind people. I'm in my mid-50s, but my parents both went through the Depression.
You're an old soul.
So these are phrases I grew up with, and I don't know. I'm stuck with them.
Rat trap cheese.
Rat trap cheese. That's right. Okay, let's go to the news of the day. President Trump is in the Middle East. He got a lavish welcome in Saudi Arabia as he kicks off his golf tour. The president, who will also visit Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, is making the first major international trip of his second term. He has told advisors that he wants to sign deals worth more than $1 trillion. Saudi Arabia gave the president a lavish welcome. Mr. Trump stepped off Air Force One at the Royal Terminal, a special section for VIPs at the airport in Riyadh, the Saudi capital. The Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman, The kingdom's de facto ruler greeted him on a lavender carpet before the two men sat down in navy and gold armchairs in an opulent sunlit building with marble columns. Mr. Trump, accompanied by Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, among other top members of his administration. Some of America's biggest business leaders were also on hand to attend an investment forum hosted by the Saudi government where Mr. Trump was due to speak, including Elon Musk and the chief executives of IBM, BlackRock, Citigroup, and NVIDIA, among others. The troop includes stops in Qatar, as well as the United Arab Emirates, and Mr. Trump will be focused on signing business deals with the three countries. JP.
This is a very important trip for the president. It is crucial for the United States to have good relationships with the major powers in the Middle East. Of course, Saudi Arabia being number one among that group, and generating investment from Saudi Arabia and other Gulf states is great for the United States economy. I did see something this morning that they signed an arms deal. That's something that makes me a little concerned. You know, us sending big, amazing, state-of-the-art killing machines to the Middle East. They have had a history of not, you know, always ending up on the right targets according to our, you know, interests. So that's a concern of mine. I would also say that as we continue to struggle with inflation in the United States and we think about tariffs and the cost of living, which is on the top of everyone's mind, that the cost of oil and gasoline is something that literally pulsates throughout every single product and good in our economy. And if there is any way for the president to get the Saudis and OPEC to increase production and lower oil prices, it would be an amazing thing for our economy.
Bob Bellafiore.
Well, you got up on the right side of the bed today, JP. Yes. I mean, this extra hour without in the show.
That's like, right.
You use that
I
hour
feel
well. Yeah, no, that was great. I'm going to agree with everything you said. I would want to put a real fine point on the final point. One of the flashpoints leading up to last year's election was gasoline prices, because everybody pays it all the time, and it is one of those things where, you know, everybody gets hit in the face with it once or twice a week every time they go to the gas station. And you know, old stories, maybe from, Joe, from where your parents and my parents came from and your folks, you know, the notion of driving 15 minutes to save a nickel on a gallon of gasoline, right? It's one of these things that people are very price sensitive about. But together with that is this notion of increasing domestic oil production. Right, the more that we are reliant on less stable or less friendly foreign countries for our oil, is a economic risk for the United States and a national security risk for the United States. Domestic oil production, I think, has become a bad guy, right? And together with conversations with the Middle East, we need to have a companion strategy for energy independence.
Mike?
Yeah, that's a good point, Bob. Currently, the economics are that it's not profitable to develop more domestic gasoline and oil because we're getting it so cheaply abroad. And the notion of being an energy independent seems to be put on a back burner by these less expensive options that are now out there. But that's volatile, and I agree, you know, it goes up and down, and people watch it, and it gives you an outsized impression of how the economy's doing, even though when it's not directly related to everything else in the economy. What I find interesting about this trip is what a lot of people have noted. This is the first foreign trip, and last time Trump was president, he went to Saudi Arabia and he was welcomed and honored, and they certainly treat him with, a red carpet welcome, et cetera, et cetera. They pull out the swords and all that, which is an honor, an honorific in that culture. But these are three, you know, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Qatar are three, you know, family, you know, kingdoms, essentially. And he's not going on to Europe like he did last time. He probably would not get that kind of welcome in Europe. Things aren't so good. He's also really ticked off people in Israel who are wondering why he's flying over them and going to the Arab states. It is good, as you say, JP, that it might ensure some investment in the U.S., but it also is a time when his family, the Trump family, is benefiting from lots of business deals with these Arab countries. And it just feels like he's paying tribute to them, they're paying tribute to him, and then add into it the proposed $400 million or $4 billion gift of a 747 from Qatar to President Trump in the United States, which President Trump will keep after he leaves office under the plan that's currently being discussed. It just feels like he's going to places where he's welcomed because he's where he'll get this kind of royal treatment, literally, and he's avoiding dealing with what have been traditionally our allies, the democracies of the planet, especially those in Europe.
And that brings us to Teresa Bourgeois.
So, yeah, I think that it's a golf trip, G-O-L-F or G-U-L-F. I'm not sure which one, right? So, and I do think that attention needs to be paid to how much of this is transactions for himself and his family and how much is for the, you know, the United States and how those lines have much more than blurred. So I think that that's something that people have to be mindful of. I was listening to the BBC during the night talking about it, and it was so interesting how they were saying that, you know, what's the goal of this? The goal is to keep him happy, you know, and I thought that that was kind of interesting. Keep him, stay on his good side. I don't know that that should be the goal when you're interacting with the President of the United States. They shouldn't have to worry about that. But I do understand what they're saying. But I also wonder about some of these deals. I did, JP, I agree with your concern about these arms deals because he seemed quite enthusiastic about the arms deals. And it seems like in every direction, with Japan, the key was arms deals. You know, there's been a lot of his focus on arms deals and what's the long-term implications of that. And the other thing is, where are these investments that are going to come into the country? And will they be in key infrastructure, U.S. infrastructures? And at the time where, for national security purposes, he's worried about, for instance, in Panama Canal, the fact that the Chinese control the ports, and even in the United States they do. What are we, are these folks who are cutting these deals being cautious about whether or not these deals will give undue influence or undue control over our domestic infrastructure? I don't know the answer to that, but I've read in a couple of places where there are some businesses who are concerned about that. And then the other concern is how much attention is being paid to businesses that could do business in those countries. It's not just doing deals, but they said they just have to make sure that they deliver on big deals. And in the last Trump administration, there were a number of big deals signed, but much of it never came to fruition. And on oil and gas, I do think, you know, I know that it's woke policy or whatever, but I'm a believer in the concerns about climate change, and I think it's real. I think the high cost of it you see in the storms and fires and such, and I think that we were in a direction where we were moving to really what I consider be energy secure, and you see in the budgets that have come out, the budget proposals for the House and the Senate on these reconciliation bills, where they're just deep, deep cuts, doing what he promised to do. You know, he met with the oil and gas people during the campaign, got his huge campaign donations, promised it would be drill, baby drill, and he would get rid of the clean energy progress that the Biden administration has made. And sure enough, he's doing that. He's pulling back funding that's already been given to communities. It's particularly harsh for low-income communities like where I was from, where eliminating the funding for the programs for what they call economic justice or climate smart communities or lower-income communities. And in any case, broad-based cuts. The solar manufacturing was coming back in the United States, and he's put a kibosh on that, and even the clean energy, Energy Star. So I do think that we should think about the long-term implications of our dependence on oil, and particularly Middle East oil. And I don't think drill, baby, drill in this country is the way to go long-term for the next generation.
How would you like to be the guy who has to think about this all day? So we sit here, our little peanut gallery in our comfy studio, and
it is comfy,
right? Almost
yeah,
lush.
It
is Qatar-esque almost.
We just need the swords.
That's right.
Would they be swords or scimitars?
Well, whatever.
Whatever. They're long, sharp things. But imagine the weight of having to figure all this stuff out. And what is in anybody's mind that they say, "I want to apply for this job. I want to apply for this job where everything is part of this multiple global spider webs that are all connected in various ways, that when you pull on one, you pull on another. I want to go to some of the major Middle East powers, which are major players in all these things, and I've got to make sure that Israel, our greatest ally in the world, doesn't feel abandoned." Right? And how to balance those two things. So now, if you're the president of the United States, you're dealing with U.S. politics and policy on how many levels, Mike? Maybe 100 at least? Right?
Layered. Several layers.
All interrelated with one another, right? Like ingredients in a massive, kettle of soup. And then you've got to be concerned about Israeli politics and how what you do impacts... I just use impact as a verb. Mike, don't ever let me do that again. You never would have let me do that in the old days. Don't ever let me use impact as a verb. How it affects Israeli politics, how that affects our allies in Israel, and then how that plays up against, whatever's going on in Europe, right? So you think about all this stuff, and the amount of triangulation isn't the word for it. I don't know that there is a geometric shape for this yet that explains all the angles that have to be played and considered for anything, right? And why would anybody want this job?
Well, it's a job he signed up for, and the way you think about it is have a strong team around you that helps you think about it. And one of the concerns that, I and others have is the first of all, what his focus is on. Is it on him or the country? And second of all, what are the team around him and what are capacities? And as he depletes the State Department, as he depletes our, national intelligence, as he depletes, other key aspects of our government, what are the implications for that? And, what is his long-term vision as opposed to Reagan's or Bush's or, the Republicans the way back a couple of years ago? Or even the Democrats. I think there's a sharp contrast. Is anybody thinking about the people of Gaza right now, who haven't had any humanitarian aid in months? And who's talking about that? That was front and center when Biden was president, and he was being harassed for it, even though he was working hard to try to provide some basic humanitarian relief. But what in any of this conversation? Not to forget that the guys who were giving him the plane want to give him the plane, which of course is illegal. But say they go forward with it, they're also the people who are providing safe harbor for Hamas. And so at the same time that this president is railing against, Hamas, and we're giving Israelis enormous weapons to destroy Hamas, I'm not opposed to that. He's taking a plane and other gifts, presumably from the country that's giving Hamas safe harbor.
Anybody else?
Well, to Bob's point, which is a good one. Why would anyone want that job? I think that President Trump has demonstrated that he doesn't look at it so complex. He looks at it from a a more simple point of view and maybe a overly simplistic point of view, and that's why he's allowed the decimation, as Teresa pointed out, of the advisors that would be stocked in the intelligence community, some of the best knowledgeable people in the world, some of the smartest people in the State Department have long been advising the presidency on this complicated, you know, mess that you described so well of all the nuances involved in managing foreign relations. And the I don't think he looks at it as being that complicated. I think he looks at it from a transactional point of view. He regards himself as the deal maker, and he's also going to benefit from it personally, and it has certainly benefited his family. And it sounds like when he's all done in the White House, he's going to have a really nice plane to fly around in.
All right.
Somebody should find a president who hasn't made out like a bandit after their administration. I'm not making an excuse for Trump.
I'm
not making an excuse for Trump.
There's nothing like we're seeing now. But just
hold on. Just about Teresa, you're doing it again.
Daily brief.
No, be nice.
You were asking. You're talking about how you know how complex it is to think about. He is reported that has fewer daily briefs than any president in recent times. I mean, that's what helps you think about these really complex things. And the head of the Pentagon rarely does daily briefs either. But those are the tools. It is an extraordinarily complex job, and we're in extraordinary times. But to your point about how challenging it is, the way you get through that is good counsel, and he's not seeking that on a regular basis.
I mean, isn't also, Bob, I mean, I understand your point about anyone who hasn't made out like a bandit on this. And there obviously have been exceptions. But I'm interested in this plane deal, for example, is like you're making out as a bandit while you're president, though. It's different than after leaving office and benefiting from the office. It's while you're in office, you're going to borrow this plane, and then when you're done, we're going to give it to you.
Oh, the plane deal is insane. I can't think of a single reason this plane deal makes one iota of sense. I mean, when you study, you know, the talks between the Allied powers at the end of World War II. And, you know, you'd go to Eastern Europe and you'd have a conference with Churchill and Roosevelt and Stalin. And you know, the Russians would want you to stay in their room. Like,
right.
No, you
Thank
don't
you.
Stay in the Russian.
Yes.
Let me.
I'm, yes.
You're doing exactly. It again.
I'm applauding you. You're absolutely right.
Right. So this plane deal, I mean, think about having to rip apart a whole plane to make sure that, you know, what's it. No, it's completely insane on every level. And I don't care about the emoluments clause or anything like that. Lawyers will figure out the legal stuff. But from a national security, from an ethics point of view, the thing makes zero sense. And it will hang around his neck like, I mean, a large bird like an albatross on this thing.
So,
and the sooner he cuts his plane loose, the better off he'll be.
The New York Times writes, during President Trump's first term, the idea that special interests and governments were buying meals and booking rooms at his hotels set off legal and ethical alarm bells around about the potential for corruption. Mr. Trump's second term is making those concerns look trivial. Yeah, right?
It does seem like he's looking at the end of his presidency as being pretty soon. When he was in there earlier in his first term, he probably envisioned an 8-year term. And now we're, you know, 5 years into that 8-year term that got interrupted by, you know, that Biden guy. But the whole thing is it takes a long time to put the brakes on, and he's going to go as far as he can. And if they put the brakes on at one point, he's really gained a lot in getting the things that he wants. And he is a personal beneficiary, and he's also his programs are definitely an ideology that he wants to embrace and continue. And, you know, he's got the playbook for it, as we know.
And Bob, I wholeheartedly agree on the security. I think so much of the discussion I've heard in the last 48 hours has been about how he's going to use it post-presidency and such. But I think the real dollar amount has to be put on what's the cost of taking that plane apart to make sure that it's, you know, safe from a national security perspective. And I can't imagine it won't be prohibitive, because one of the reasons the plane that's on order is not ready yet is because of all of that they have to do to make it an Air Force One plane. And it's going to take a long time. And what I was shocked at, I didn't realize there was an article about this in the first week of May in the Wall Street Journal, talking about, and there's already been a contract with a company has already started working on this. It's the work on it is already underway. And so, you know, I think the public deserves to know what it's going to cost the Pentagon to make this safe enough from all the national security perspectives. And I want to compare that against the cuts in the police programs, the cuts in the small business programs, ag programs, food programs, and on and on and on. You know, what's the trade-off?
I spent some time trying to figure this out last night, and I assume since I don't have an answer, I didn't spend enough time. So I apologize, but I don't know the answer to this. And if it's really easy to find, then I will admit that I just didn't work hard enough. But what I was trying to figure out is that there was a kerfuffle right after Trump took office again. There was a kerfuffle that he was all upset at Boeing for not getting this plane that he wanted. And they had ordered the plane, and the plane wasn't coming in, and he was mad, and so forth. So then I see in the picture in the New York Times today, you were talking about May, but in February, when the plane went to West Palm Beach and the president went on the plane and visited the plane and checked, this is the one in question now that is going to be the loaner. And so what happened to the original plane? Like, so is that still being built?
Boeing is building two planes under contract that began before Trump took office the first time.
What year?
Back in 2016. 16. I mean, they knew they needed to replace these aging Air Force Ones.
Obama set it in motion for a new plane.
It was already in motion, but it was not being delivered in a timely fashion. And,
well,
you know,
hold
Boeing
on. They,
is way
they
behind.
They say 12 years later.
Yeah.
Like when you say I'm going to build you something in 12 years, I interpret that to be I'm never going to get it. We are never going to get it. And the tell me.
I mean, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It's a crazy amount of time, but what I read was part of the problem was during COVID supply chain concerns.
That's a ridiculous excuse. And 12 years to build a plane?
That might be a year delay.
Then they had
or maybe
changes
two.
In technology. I mean, it doesn't make sense. Doesn't make sense.
But Boeing is certainly deserving of criticism for taking a long time to deliver on this enormously important contract. There's a lot of reasons why it is complicated, and all the security that has to be built into this, and all the extra armor that has to be built in, extra engine power, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Trump was impatient with it during his first Trump term and brokered a deal with Boeing that they would deliver it or he was going to cancel the contract. And then he froze it at a certain amount, and they agreed to the certain amount that they're going to build the two planes for. And in the meantime, he gets out of office, he comes back in, and they're still working on it, and he's really kicking Boeing quite a bit.
Well, and they also...
I'm sorry, but is that when the talks of the loaner came in?
Well, he went and looked at the plane when it came to West Palm Beach back in February, and then used
kicked
that...
Kicked the tires a little bit.
Right, kicked the tires, and said, this is a beautiful airplane, you know, and why can't Boeing deliver like it did to the... to the Qatarians or Qatarans, why can't they deliver that to us in a timely fashion? And the next thing you know,
and it's not like Boeing,
you can have it.
And it's also not like it's not like Boeing's doing it for free, right? They're getting hundreds of millions of dollars,
right?
From,
but they're
from
not getting price.
And they're saying right now, as of 2025, it's still 3 years away after it's been on order. For a decade, we're still 3 years away. Now, when I hear that, what are the odds that it's going to be ready in 3 years? I would say the odds are zero.
No. But apparently now
we are never going to see this.
Trump
plane.
Has Elon Musk working with them, and they want to make additional changes. But
okay, I need to take a quick break. We missed 10:30, so let me take a quick break. We'll pause, and we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Listening to Bela Fleck, and a playlist is posted online, WAMC.org. So we are talking about, we're having a vigorous conversation about the plane. The administration's plan to accept a $400 million luxury jet from the Qatari royal family, which is now being questioned by several groups and individuals who say that this would violate federal law. But this is, as the New York Times says, this administration is showing striking disdain for one-time norms of propriety and for traditional legal and political guardrails around public service, meaning they are clearly emboldened. Bob.
Well, I want to say we are all having a Hervé Villechaize moment, because all we are talking about is the plane. And there is a larger issue. I mean, we've already stipulated, right? The plane is idiotic, right? Somebody should save Trump from himself and say, leave the plane in the Qatari hangar and move on. But JP, you made the point that Boeing said it was going to take 12 years to make the plane, right? We have an unbelievable problem in the United States in manufacturing our own transportation military infrastructure. This plane takes forever. America used to have 40 defense contractors in the middle of the Cold War. We now have 6, right? It takes forever to get aircraft carriers built. China spits them out like widgets. There is a fundamental problem to go along with all the other things that we're talking about, that this, right, this plane is, right, aside from all the ethic issues, which I think we all agree to, right? It's might be the dumbest thing Trump has ever done. And for some people in this room, that would be a lot of competition for that. But there is a major problem in this country in making things. And it goes to all of that, what goes into permitting, what goes into cost, the complete cost effectiveness of doing things overseas, right? There's a fundamental issue. And JP, you pointed it out with the 12 years to build a plane, right? That means you're never getting the plane. And we have the military never getting their aircraft carriers. And we have never, you know, not getting fighter jets and all these things that are hard for us to build. And that's a long-term problem for this country.
And I agree with that. One thing that I would add to it is that not just him getting the gift and it being a grift and a corrupt move, it's that it's coming from Qatar. And Qatar has a very unique thing that other countries don't have, which is they provide the leaders of Hamas with safe harbor in their country. So the leaders of Hamas don't live in Palestine, which if you ask the people in Palestine or people that go to places that are tough to live, probably the last place a human being would ever want to live right now is in Palestine. And the leaders of Hamas are given safe harbor in Qatar. Now, I'm old enough to remember George Bush when he would say, if you harbor the terrorists, we're going to treat you like the terrorists. And I don't know why we have gone away from that. But I also don't know why Trump is going to Qatar. I also don't know why we allow Qatar to give safe harbor to these Hamas terrorists to live in the lap of luxury while they plan and execute terrorist attacks on innocent Jews, and then Israel goes and attacks their people in Palestine, and the Hamas leadership gets to hang out, you know, in their swimming pools and hot tubs in Qatar. I don't understand that dynamic, and I don't understand why, once we get as many of the hostages back that we can, that we don't destroy all those people in Qatar.
Yeah, I mean, President Trump called out Qatar when in his first term as harboring terrorists and supporting Hezbollah and Hamas, and Now they've bought their way back into good graces. The way they tried to buy their way back into good graces by hosting the FIFA, you know, the World Cup soccer tournament, and then the corruption associated with that, and then the death and the practical slavery of the foreign workers they brought in, and many of them died because of their inhumane conditions that they were working in. I mean, all of that is when Qatar has a problem, they try to buy their way out of it because they have so much freaking money. And that is just a reality. And that's why they're getting respect from Donald Trump now, because he really likes people who treat him nice, and he likes people who have a lot of freaking money, and he might get some of it. And he, you know, it's no, you're so right. Somebody needs, Bob, somebody needs to rescue Trump from this and say, just turn around and walk away from it. And he probably will. And then at the end of his presidency, maybe they'll just give it to Qatar, so they'll just give it to him anyway, and he'll get what he wants. But
which would be fine.
Yeah, I mean, it's right. I mean, you know, you can complain about it, you know, but it'll be history then. I mean, it won't be his as president. And but the worry is, they say, let's just step away from this now, Mr. Trump, and you'll have it at the end. Sure. They've already got such outsized influence right now with him that's the real problem.
And but it's not just the plane, it's the business deals. I mean, how many deals are his family doing in those countries that he's visiting over the next few days, right? And, you know, what about the Kushner Fund and with the Saudis, right? And I think this is deep and complex, and something that those who are ethics watchers say that they've never seen anything like this.
They have seen stuff like it, right?
Not to this extent.
We remember in the previous administration, there was the son of the president decided to become an artist and sell his paintings for hundreds of thousands of dollars per painting. Now, if one of the Trump sons, and didn't disclose the buyers, now if one of the Trump sons said, hey, I'm going to become an artist and open a gallery in New York City, I'm going to sell my paintings.
What about the meme coins?
You're just saying that we've never seen it before. We have seen it before.
Not to this extent. I don't know. I'm not a student of this. But also, while we're talking about this, which is important to talk about, we're not talking about the broader issues of what they're, what they're doing with the budget, which I think is deeply troubling. And I do believe that it's. You know, you talk about the plane. It's what's important to talk about, and he knows. I mean, it's just this. It's like his ongoing TV show. He keeps changing the, you know, a new. But in the meantime, what are the costs? The same company, I believe, that's supposedly working to fix this new plane to make it secure is the one that's supposed to be working on the Boeing plane that the taxpayers are already paying for, and we need those two planes. Ultimately, we're going to need those two planes for the next president. He has a plane. Why would the taxpayers be paying for yet another one, and what would the cost be, and what are the trade-offs?
I want to get to a couple of letters before we take another break. We go to this from John. So let me get this straight. Trump wants to bring back manufacturing in 90 days so he taxes imports. He can't get an American-made Air Force One in 12 years so he gets a free imported plane?
Well, that was made by Boeing in the United States for the Qataris. I mean, I don't know how they could build it so fast for them. Maybe they just paid more.
Where are the red
hats
being
made? Maybe they
didn't
have to competitively bid for the contract.
Where are his hats being made? China still? Where are his Bibles being made? China still? Where are all the things? You know, he talks about how we have to stop, you know, bringing in things from China. Well, what's he bringing in from China?
Is there more in the letter?
Sorry.
Yeah. Lori, no, it's Laura, says, why would Trump get to use a specially equipped plane when he is not the president? What is the value of that? Will the special equipment be removed for security reasons before he gets it? And what will that cost? So the question here is, if once he's done using it as the loaner and then it becomes his personal plane, then what?
He gets to keep the upgrades.
What is going to change in that? No prior president has had the use of an Air Force One after they left the presidency, have they? After all, he stripped security briefings and clearances from Biden and others when he took office. Is Congress the body that stops this, or does someone have to sue to stop him?
As a question of fact, no president has ever flown on Air Force One after his administration, because Air Force One is the name of the plane the president is on. Plenty of presidents have flown in private jets. In fact, that's probably how most of them ex-presidents.
And the Reagan, they pointed to the Reagan getting a plane, but that was a decommissioned plane that was not going to fly, that's in his library. It's not usable. It's a tourist.
And it's actually loaned.
It's an artifact.
Right.
It's just, I've seen it. It's
right.
very cool.
It's very cool. It's a great way for, it's a wonderful thing.
It's an artifact. But I just wanted to be the copy editor on the person.
It's like the copter there that when Nixon left.
Mm. Right.
They have that at the Nixon Library. Mm. Well, that's just cool.
That's history.
Yeah. But it's a historical artifact.
Absolutely.
Also, Bob, I take your point about bringing manufacturing back. But if you're serious about bringing manufacturing back, you're not making deep cuts in research and development and university-based research. Because that is what sparks innovation, and that's what prepares the scientists and engineers and the people we need to bring manufacturing back and figure out what the next thing is and do the robots and such. You're not cutting workforce development so that we have the workers who have the capacity to do that kind of work. And that's what he's doing. So he says he's for bringing manufacturing, but he's, again, cutting off the processes to do just that.
Just to be a devil's advocate, real quick, we've been doing all that stuff and have lost manufacturing. So has it worked?
Well, when Biden focused the last 4 years on bringing back clean energy manufacturing, it was working until Trump came in and he's just cut all the supports for it, because he was looking at all aspects of bringing back, for instance, a solar panel development in this country, which we lost to China, which we should not have. And he was effectively doing that through a broad-based look at it. So you can do it if you work at it.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll finish up with this group, Bob Bellafiore, Teresa Bourgeois, J.P. Miller, and Mike Spain. You're listening to the Roundtable Panel on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable Panel, and we're going to 11 o'clock this morning. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We would love to hear from you in our remaining moments, and let's see, we'll go to one more topic. And we'll go to the GOP budget cuts. Republicans want budget cuts, but not the political consequences. This is the news analysis from the New York Times. House Republicans face a fundamental problem as they reach a critical phase in crafting their, quote, one big beautiful bill to enact President Trump's agenda. They want to slice deeply into federal programs without acknowledging that they are doing any meaningful damage to their constituents or states. This vexing situation arises from the natural tension between the conservative determination to roll back federal spending and the tendency of politicians to want to keep their jobs. Doing the former can work against the latter. There's a lot here, and we don't have a whole lot of time, but Teresa, it just seems to me that since the beginning of time, or at least government, we have talked about how this phase of trying to give everybody what they want without a spiking price tag is the ultimate balance that is done at budget time.
Well, I think the challenge that the Republicans have is led by Trump and Vance. They've been saying, we're not going to cut Medicaid, we're not going to cut Medicare, we're not going to hurt Social Security, and we're not going to touch the things that matter to you, and we're going to get prices down. While all that time in the House and Senate conference rooms, they were moving bills that do just that, really modeled after the Project 2025 and a couple of the other think tanks that a lot of folks are involved in, and really codifying a lot of the cuts that the Musk and his folks with Vance and Vogt working on it together have been making. And so they've been making them in a way that's not legal, and the courts have been tossing them out. But once they codify them, it does make them legal, and in a pretty haphazard way, I would say. So the question is, you know, it's just all about choices. It's all about what you want to invest in, what are your priorities, and their priorities are tax cuts that benefit the top 1% predominantly. I think what the Democrats need to do is show a tax package that does help the working class and doesn't balloon the deficits. But the problem is, just like with the health care bill, when they wanted to get rid of the Obamacare, they can't figure out a way to really make the math work. The math just doesn't add up in what they're trying to do. So what's on the table is zero out Meals on Wheels, contingent congregate meals, all sorts of SNAP programs. Senator Schumer was here in the Capital Region yesterday with a whole host of people, veterans, others, talking about the range of food programs that are gone and may not come back. Agriculture is going to take a pretty serious hit, across the board, higher education, K through 12. And really, it depends on if you really want to go in the direction that they're taking us or not. And either way, it's going to balloon the deficits.
Anyone else?
So it's really a battle within the Republican Party right now, right? Because they have such a narrow majority. And the New York and California Republicans, a very small number of moderate Republicans, want the SALT tax break. They also do not want such deep cuts. They want to play the game of, we're moderates, we're not really cutting, and we want a more palatable bill. Then they are battling the far right, which says, no, we were elected to cut government spending. We run a $2 trillion deficit every year. We're $30 trillion in debt. The American people want us to cut spending. The moderates disagree with that and don't want to go along with that. The moderate Republicans want to be kind of Democratic light. And what happens, it'll be interesting to see what happens. I don't think we've ever had actual cuts to the government. I think what we usually have is slowing the rate of growth of government. I can't imagine that next year the federal government is going to spend less money than they did this year. I don't think that that's ever happened, where one year we spend less money than we do the previous year. But it's basically slowing the rate of growth. And these Republicans have to imagine that they're going to have, of course, a very tough reelection campaign in another, not even 18 months, 16 months from now. They're all going to be up for re-election, and they know that in first terms of presidencies that the incumbent White House tends to lose a number of seats, both in the House and the Senate, during their midterm.
Real fast, what you described from that story can be summarized in two words. That's politics. I've yes to credit, no to criticism. That's every politician's motto. Two, raising spending is easy. It creates beneficiaries, then makes it hard to take away. But the level of spending that you have in the federal government and what it spends on is not sustainable, right? And programs started out of good intentions get out of control and end up being, you know, people say waste, fraud, and abuse. There is some of that, but some of the stuff clearly has to be retained. Otherwise, we will never get out of this hole. And three, if there's one thing I learned in 8 years in the Pataki administration, was the economics never works fast enough for the politics to be satisfied. So you do a thing, and it's like pulling a lever from a vending machine. You pull the thing, and the candy bar has to come out. Right. And that's the way you describe it. Oh, we're going to do congestion pricing. 10 minutes later, traffic is better in Manhattan, right? It's just doesn't work that way.
That did happen, though.
Yeah, actually, the traffic
that did
got
happen.
Better.
Yeah,
but you could give another example.
No, but what I heard yesterday was, but it's gone back up. So anyway, so that's a quick thing. Nobody wants to be criticized in politics, but everybody wants credit.
All right, we are out of time. My thanks to this great group for this morning and helping us out. Bob Bellafiore, Teresa Bourgeois, J.P. Miller, Mike Spain, thank you all. We'll be back with another hour of the Roundtable coming up. after top of the hour business, and then we'll return with more show after this.